This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Candidates for Cincinnati mayor and city council make their final push before Tuesday's election. And joining us to discuss the final days of campaigning are WCPO.com politics and government reporter Paula Christian, Cincinnati Inquirer political columnist Jason Williams, and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. You can join our conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Paula, Jason, and Howard, thanks everybody for being here this afternoon. Good to see all of you.
Thanks very much.
You know, we've got just a few days remaining before the election. So, Howard, what in these remaining few days, how do things shift? How does the campaigns change? What are they emphasizing and focusing on at this point?
Well, one thing that happens on the fringes of the campaigns, and sometimes at the center of the campaigns, like in the mayor's race, it just gets very nasty and very ugly. And you start seeing these attack pieces popping up, you know, whether mail pieces or pieces that are being distributed. I can guarantee you that on Sunday, if you drive up and down Reading Road past all of the black churches in Cincinnati, because black voters are going to be very much a key to this thing, you're going to see the parking lots full of cars that have maybe a dozen flyers tucked
under the windshield wipers
for every conceivable candidate. Some of them positive messages, some of them attack things, some of them you'll know where they came from, some of them you won't know. And it's going to take a trip up and down Reading Road Sunday morning. It would be
but we were talking about off the air if those are really effective at all, if people really pay attention to them.
I don't know. I mean, I've only seen really here locally one campaign where I thought direct mail was very effective, and that was Mark Mallory's campaign in 2005. And that was pretty much, for the most part, a positive message, but he wasn't attacking. He wasn't going after David Pepper. He was going after city council and talking about how city council was in chaos and they couldn't get anything done. And he was an outsider. He wasn't part of that mess. And he could come in and fix it. And people, I think, responded to that message. And the mail pieces were brilliant. They were beautiful. And I don't think people threw them away at all. I think people did look at them.
Jason, what are you expecting to see in the final days of this campaign?
Much like what Howard said, it's just the nastiness. You know, we're seeing that right now with there's these illegal flyers that have been put out smearing Cranley as they're very racially charged. I'm not even sure if they've I've heard people say they've hit mailboxes. I've heard others say that they've just been being passed out. There's probably a little bit of both. So yeah. There's been three of them so far. I'm not sure if there'll be another one today or So, yeah, I think CPO and us just posted something about that, and should be interesting. I don't think this kind of stuff moves the needle.
No.
I really don't.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
And that's either way, you know. So, I mean, Cranley's been his, there's a nonprofit, dark money nonprofit, run by his former chief of staff.
Right.
Who've been hitting with mail pieces on the children's issue. I think it all gets a lot. I mean, my desk right now is piled up with flyers, and it's just crazy. So
yeah.
I don't even live in the city, but someone brings them to me. So my thoughts are this stuff gets lost in the mail if you're getting – I mean, if you live in the city and you get 10 pieces like this a day
– Oh, yeah. Yeah,
I'm tossing that stuff in the trash can.
Or people who say I'm sick of politics,
can't
stand this anymore. Right. Yeah. So I'm going to read it.
Yeah.
I talked to a Xavier class who is interning for six city council candidates, and they're out there distributing this stuff. And they said that on the doorsteps, there's literally stacks of other campaign literature, and they're just like. They're having a contest of who can collect the most literature from other campaigns. And they're just wondering, like, is everybody targeting the exact same voters? And in some cases, they are.
These things are only effective when they're very narrowly targeted and targeted towards, you know, certain groups of voters that you need or you identify as your supporters and you want to get them out. And otherwise, you know, just stuffing mailboxes with stuff or sticking stuff in car windows, it doesn't get it. It doesn't help.
Or, I mean, if I could add this.
Sure.
Maybe it does have an impact, but it's a reverse impact.
Yeah,
that people are tired of the negativity. And I don't know. I think the primary, you know, Cranley did some attack pieces, and it certainly didn't help him. I don't know if it went against him or not, but or in terms of, I don't know if people respond to that by wanting to go against him. But my sense is Cincinnati doesn't really respond to negativity very well.
Well, Howard was talking about Mark Mallory's campaign where he's put out the positive flyers.
Yeah, that was great messaging.
You think people are more receptive to that kind of a message?
And I think this election will be very neighborhood specific. I think that people are going to be asking, what was done in my neighborhood over the last 4 years? Is my neighborhood better or worse? Is my life better or worse? And, you know, the person in Westwood, that might be different from the person in College Hill, or the person in Hyde Park is certainly going to be different from a North Avondale. So I just think it's just going to be super specific. And I also think the more the candidate can put in face time with a particular voter, I think their chances of winning that vote skyrocket. I don't think mailers are effective. I just don't.
Can I add some?
Sure.
If I could make this clear to the listeners, is that these attack pieces that have come out against Cranley this week were done by an outside group, not by the Simpson campaign.
No. Mm-hmm. Okay. Oh, no. No.
Yeah, so the source
they were not,
is
no.
not.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's not the Simpson campaign doing this kind of stuff. There are other people doing this kind of stuff. And there are so many ways, Jason, to get around the laws. And they're using them. They're using some of those ways.
Yeah.
Because it's been established pretty much in court cases, elections commission cases, if a piece does not specifically use the magic words being vote against or vote
for
so-and-so out.
Some type of call to action.
Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, then they can pass it off as some kind of educational piece.
The buzzword is advocacy.
Right. Advocacy is the buzzword. Educational is another one. You know, and it's a scam, and it's happened. I've been doing this since the dawn of time, and it's been happening every one of these, especially these local elections. You know, every 2 years for as long as I've been around. And it happens in the last week or two. Hmm. It just, like, skyrockets, escalates, because there's desperation out there. You know, this is it. This is their last shot.
On both sides.
Both sides.
Absolutely.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, Paula, how important is the ground game going to be for both the candidates?
Oh, I think that's everything. I spent a lot of time with the Xavier class just trying to get their perspective on, you know, what voters think. I mean, these students have literally talked and walked hundreds of miles, talked to thousands of people. And they say that FaceTime is everything, that people will actually ask them, well, where's your candidate? Why aren't they here speaking to me? Why are you here? If your candidate really wanted my vote, why isn't he or she standing here? And they're also super specific about, look, I'm trying to provide for my family. I don't really care about this election. Like, it's not affecting my life in a way that's going to prompt me to go out and vote on Tuesday. So I'm very curious to see what turnout will be.
Yeah. What as far as the early voter turnout goes, what are the numbers we're seeing there?
Well, it's better. I mean, it's certainly better than 2013.
Marginally, I think. Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's a little better. But I'm not sure what an indication that is of what's going to happen on Tuesday. I think basically, you know, like in a city, two out of three voters are going to stay home, probably. And
which is really unfortunate.
It is very unfortunate. I mean, it's ridiculous. You know, I mean, what matters more on a local basis, on your neighborhood basis, on your day-to-day life, than what happens in your city, the city in which you live, and where your kids go to school? Because we're electing a school board, too.
Mm-hmm.
in Cincinnati. So, but, you know, to have like 33, 34, 35% turnout, that's
and that's considered abysmal. Good. I mean, that's for...
Well, there have been worse, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Sure.
It's just sad. I mean, it's better than the 11% in the primary, but it's...
Yeah, and you go to back the history of these direct mayoral elections, they range from about 29% to about 42%. You know, it's never been massive.
Paula, you were saying the early voter turnout numbers are better than previous mayoral elections.
Well, 2013.
2013. That's the only thing you can really compare it to.
What are the numbers at this point? Do you know?
I don't know off the top of my head. Maybe you know, Jason.
I checked in yesterday, and it was...
I look at them every day, but I don't know the exact number.
I get the email every morning from Board of Elections, but I can't remember the specific numbers.
Through Wednesday, it was up 16% versus this time in 2013. However, there are 15,000 more registered voters now than there were in 2013. Yes. So,
and I was talking to Sherry Poland, the elections director, this morning about it. And obviously, in the absentee balloting, you know, the mail-in ballots, those are up among Republicans. And in the in-person voting at the Board of Elections, it's up among Democrats, which is not really too hard to figure out. Mm-hmm. That's what you would expect.
And one of the reasons why the Board of Elections believes that the uptick is there is because of actually issue two, which is a prescription drug pricing initiative on the ballot, statewide initiative, because the folks who are against that send out absentee ballot applications to targeted toward Republican voters in the city and coming all over Hamilton County.
Right. And that's driving this whole thing. You know, and Sherry said that, you know, she talked about the 35% possible turnout within the city and said it will probably be higher outside the city. And that's exactly the reason, because of issue two and because there are more Republican voters out there who have gotten these absentee ballots or who just plain, you know, are going to go to the polls and vote this thing down.
We will continue our conversation, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney.
People forget that part of our success is rebuilding that foundation of a balanced budget, structurally balanced budget, of dealing with tough issues that have been ignored for years, like the pension crisis. And upon that success, we're seeing GE and Kroger and Children's and all these other great investments in our city because they have a partner that's financially credible.
Well, the pension failed under his leadership. He was on the pension board when we started to see failures and redirected $50 million in Anthem money that should have gone into the pension. So he knows this better than most. We started to see structural imbalance when he was chair of budget and finance. This was before I got here. I was in law school at the time. And so it's very interesting to take credit for the fact that we're fixing these things now. But those very problems that he's saying have been kicked down the can for years were created by him.
John Cranley and Yvette Simpson, who were on Cincinnati Edition yesterday, and that was their last head-to-head debate before Tuesday's election. Howard?
Well, what you just heard was typical of what they did yesterday. And both of them, in those comments about the pension system, what they said was true, but it wasn't the whole story. Neither one of them told the whole story. And, you know, that's what they do. They tell the part that fits their own scenario. And that's what you hear in those kind of debates, unless you keep questioning them. And it's up to us, the news media, to fill in the blanks.
Now, Yvette Simpson won by 11% in the primary. Do you think, Jason, can she duplicate that success? Does she really even need to duplicate that to
I absolutely believe she can duplicate I mean, and when. I mean, I will continue to say this. I think it's going to be a long night. I think much the same way I think about Dennis Dieters and Denise Driehaus last year, that it could go to provisionals and it's flip a coin. And I wouldn't be surprised either way about, you know, if Cranley came back and won, I wouldn't be surprised. If Yvette pulls it out, wouldn't be surprised.
Right.
When I asked Yvette that same question, she said, I don't need 11%. I just need 51% of the vote. So she just wants to win. She doesn't need a blowout.
It doesn't matter if you win by 1% or 2%. Okay.
It's a win's a win.
I agree. I absolutely with Jason. I think it's going to be it's just going to go on and on and on, and it's going to be a long time before we know how it's going to shake out. It's going to be interesting to see if we can how closely we can track where votes are coming from.
But early turnout voting, is, those early voting numbers will be the very
be some,
important to watch.
Yeah, they will, I think, to a certain extent. But I don't want to put too much into them because, you know, if, in fact, as Sherry Poland was telling me, they're trending Republican in terms of the mail-in ballots, that might skew things a little bit.
Yeah, the Republican early voting in the city is up between around 12%.
Yeah.
The Democrats are up 20%.
Right. Well, yeah, that's right. And, you know, you had a situation, I think, in the spring in the May primary where there were probably a lot of Republican voters who weren't even aware there was an election going on because they didn't have a candidate.
Yep.
There were three Democrats on the ballot. They didn't go out. They weren't particularly happy with any one of the three who were running in the primary. And now it's going to be a matter of, you know, who, you know, can they get those people out, particularly for John Cranley, whether or not he can get those people out and get them to vote for him. And he's got some help. Pete Whitty with his power pack on the west side, which is, you know, raise some money to, you know, do flyers and stuff for Cranley and an endorsed slate of council candidates. But, you know, those people were just gone in May, you know, so we don't know where they're at and whether or not they're going to come out on Tuesday.
Yeah, the maps of the west side in the primary were
ludicrous. Yeah.
Does Cranley have some extra motivation because he didn't do as good a job getting out his voters in that primary? Is he going to be more determined?
Well,
not to make the same mistakes.
He was embarrassed. I mean, he didn't just lose. I mean, it was a humiliating loss. So, and you know, John Cranley doesn't like to lose. So, I mean, that changed his entire campaign. I mean, he got rid of high-level staffers. He started a ground game, which is something he's never done before. And, I mean, his ground game is – I mean, they've hit 90,000 doors in the last 6 months, which that's kind of – that's huge. That's an epic number of doors.
Their knuckles have got to be very sore at this point, unless they're using the doorbell, right?
Well, and he told me that in the last 10 days before the election, they're going back to 11,500 voters who have committed to them that they will support him. They're going back to them one more time to ask them specifically, are you voting? What's your plan to vote? And Yvette's doing essentially the same thing. I mean, her pre-primary, you know, they called like 30 or 40,000 people in the 48 hours before the May primary. Well, they're trying to double that number and call 80,000 people, make sure that they're getting to the polls. So it's really a sprint to the finish.
It'll be I mean, if Cranley wins, it will it'll be impressive in the sense that his entire political career, he's never relied on the ground game.
Yep.
And this guy, you know, he was on council for 9 years and he ran a couple failed congressional races. Obviously, this is his second, I guess it's his fourth mayoral race when you count the two primaries. He's always relied on messaging, on advertising heavily. He did that in the primary and spent nearly $1 million on TV and radio ads, and it got him all of, 36% of the vote or something. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
He kind of got that when he ran for Congress in 2000 and 2006. And he kind of got this DCCC message pounded into his head that you've got to, you know, spend all this money on TV and all that sort of thing. And, you know, it doesn't work that way when you're running for mayor or for city council. I mean, he, you know, this is a different thing. You have to have personal contact with the voters, the kind of thing that Paul is talking about, where you not only see them once, you go back and see them again. And so, you sure? You going to get there?
You're definitely coming, right?
We can help you.
You're going to vote, right?
We can help you get there.
Yeah.
I think Howard could attest to this better than I could, just with his institutional knowledge and years of covering politics. But I sense that it's changed, or there's a shift that people even want that even more so now, that personal connection after Bernie and Trump really really revolutionized campaigning last year, and more of this kind of willy-nilly, you know, anything goes, but I'm going to just be genuine or and connect with voters, whether it's by Twitter or just...
Yeah.
That's something really interesting.
Absolutely.
The Xavier students... They all had to present their own campaign budgets, how they would spend the money if they were running the city council campaign. And on all of them, they took the money away from TV advertising, which I didn't like to see. And then they put it all in social media, a lot of it in social media and a lot of it in the ground game, which I thought was fascinating. And I mean, these are the 19-year-old kids that are doing the brunt of the work out there. They just, I think, maybe have a better handle on what's really effective.
Yeah. Well, I, you know, and TV is one thing, and I know, you know, the TV stations love it, obviously, but, you know, frankly, you're spending a whole lot of money talking to people who can't vote for you in the first place because, you know, the signal doesn't stop at the city limits. So these other things, as and social media is can be very effective if you use it correctly. And but there is nothing in a city council race or a city mayoral race that beats just like good old fashioned door knocking and talking to people. Talk to them directly.
So how what do you think are the top issues that are driving the mayor's race?
Well, I'm not sure that, you know, well, there are neighborhood, there are different issues. Okay.
Did my street get paved?
Did my street
get
paved?
Did I get that new development?
Yeah.
Grocery store?
Why don't we have a decent business district in our neighborhood when the neighborhood next door has a great one that's thriving? You know, it's those kind of things. It's like real life in my neighborhood, on my street type of issues that people want to hear about. And to a large extent, you know, both candidates are trying to do that. But it's very difficult. It's not big picture stuff. I think they're done with the big picture
stuff.
And there's
no real driving issue. There's no streetcar. There's just a thousand little issues that that are just so specific to your, you know, what you can see out your front window.
I mean, you have to have a different message when you go into every neighborhood almost, you know, when you go to every community council meeting or candidates night. You have to speak directly to those people in that part of Cincinnati.
Let's talk to Heather, who joins us now. Hi, Heather. Hello, Heather.
Can you hear me?
Sure can.
Hello?
Yes.
Okay. So I've been listening to you guys talk about candidates, whether local or state or national, for about 3 months now. And I feel like I'm listening to a political version of ESPN. I'm hearing ground game and, you know, who's doing what and who can, you know, strategy for who to turn out the vote, how to turn out the vote. But I've yet to hear about the actual messages, about the policies that are being promoted. I'm hearing more policy from, you know, football players kneeling about an issue. You know, I mean, like, when is ESPN turning into politics?
Okay, Heather, Howard has an answer for you.
I understand exactly what you're saying, Heather, but I don't know if you had an opportunity yesterday afternoon to listen to this show, Cincinnati Edition, where we had sitting right here, Yvette Simpson and John Cranley talking about the issues for a solid hour. WCPO has done that. The Enquirer has done that. There's been a lot of coverage in the news media and debates and more debates, some broadcasts, some live streamed on Facebook. And yesterday
you've
afternoon,
written about things extensively on your website.
Well, yeah, sure.
Jason and Paula, I'm sure.
But
written
at
about
this
the
time
well,
yesterday, so, 24 yeah. hours ago, you could have sat there and listened to the two of them talk nothing but issues.
And literally, they have answered what I feel like is the same questions about issues from the Western Hills Viaduct to Police District 5 to the heroin epidemic thousands of times over the last year. But I wonder if what she's saying is that
overall, I think she's picked up on a trend and a tone that you often hear in political reporting.
Well, yeah.
To cover it as though it's a race or a game of some kind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
it is kind of a chess match.
But it is.
You know, it's interesting. Like, I'm a former sports writer, and I've thought it's very similar to covering sports in that there are winners and losers. It's very intense. There's a lot of back and forth and late nights and
the competitive aspect.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
I think it's an astute point that Heather makes.
And it is an astute point that Heather makes. The one thing I wanted to add to that, though, was that one of the reasons why we talk about the process and what's going on and it makes it kind of sound like, you know, we're doing a horse race. We're trying to put it in context. We're trying to put the message of the candidates into context. Why are they saying these things to you? What's their purpose? What's their record behind it? Is it inconsistent with what they've said in the past? So if we can do things like that, then we're performing a service for the voters.
And I agree with Howard. And I also – maybe it's been more prevalent in this race than if you pay attention to local politics than maybe in 13 because there hasn't been a real one or two clear-cut issues like there was in 2013 where you had the street card. You're either going to do it or you're going to die. And we had candidates on each side of that. You had privatizing the city's parking meters issue at that time, and those were very hot-button issues.
Well, Jason, Paul, and Howard, thank you for joining us this afternoon. WCPO.com politics and government reporter Paula Christian, Cincinnati Enquirer political columnist Jason Williams, and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. Coming up, we'll break down issues 1 and 2 on the Ohio ballot and talk about the latest from the Ohio governor's race. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, along with Howard Wilkinson. Ohio voters will be deciding on issues 1 and 2, Marcy's Law and the Drug Price Relief Act, on Tuesday. We spoke yesterday with Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles about the two issues and the latest in the Ohio governor's race. Joe, thank you for joining us today.
It's great to be here.
Let's start with issue 1, which is also known as Marcy's Law. Now, what's issue 1? What's it going to do if it happens to pass?
Well, Marcy's Law is a proposed constitutional amendment, and what it does is there are some rights that Ohio crime victims already have. But in some areas of the state, those rights are not afforded to them. For example, basically, you have the right to know when someone's going to get out on parole if you're the crime victim, or if there's a hearing coming up, or if you want to attend the hearing. That information should be given to you. But it isn't always given to people. And so Marcy's Law is from a group in California. In fact, it's one man in California whose sister was murdered. The family ran into this man in the grocery store just days, afterwards. They
totally
thought
by surprise, right?
Yeah.
They had
totally
no idea.
By
the
surprise.
The mother, I think, yeah.
Yeah, and it was very jarring for them, very upsetting. So the brother has started this campaign that he's taking nationwide, and Ohio's Marcy's Law is based on the one they have in California. And basically, it would put all the protections for the victims in the Constitution. Now, you're saying, well, what's wrong with that? It probably should be there. The other side, though, is the ACLU of Ohio and some other groups are saying, you know, the Prosecuting Attorneys Association actually is on this, too. They say the problem is that in the Marcy's Law has this thing in it where it eliminates some of the okay, let me explain this a little bit better. Let me back up. Right now, if an attorney is representing someone, they can go to the victim of a crime and they can ask for emails and they can ask for documentation. They can ask for a videotape that they think might prove that the person that they are representing is innocent. Right. Under Marcy's Law, there would be the right of the crime victim to refuse discovery. And at that point, if they refuse to offer those things as is asked for by a defense attorney, then there is another way that the defense attorney can get that. They can go to court, they can get a subpoena, they can override it and, you know, still get it. But you're putting a level in there that doesn't exist now.
Because the accused has rights too.
Right, exactly. The accused has rights, and this, you know, the Prosecuting Attorneys Association, the ACLU, says that's a problem because you're now giving the victims more rights than you are the accused, and the accused are the ones, you know, they want to get the right person. So there's an upside, a downside, but if it passes, it's going in the Constitution.
So the folks who are opposing this, the groups that are opposing this, they're concerned about the legal ramifications, the legal issues that could arise because of Marcy's Law.
Right. And, you know, because it is a constitutional amendment, lawmakers couldn't come back and pass a law to fix it. It's in there.
Right. And most of these things are already in Ohio law.
Right.
They're, you know, they already exist in Ohio law. But Joe's exactly right. They're not always enforced in every one of the 88 counties. You know, very religiously. Hamilton County, I know, does a pretty good job with victims' assistance and that sort of thing, make sure that their rights are observed. Some other counties may not be as diligent about that, and that is a problem.
Right.
Joe, how much campaign spending has gone into issue one compared to issue two?
Oh, wow. That is such a disparity.
Yeah.
Issue one has just a small amount of campaign spending, all of it on the pro side. But right. Issue two, I mean, that's the behemoth. If you look at the anti-issue two side, $58 million was raised and will be spent before this is over with. And some even say it's higher than that. We can't see exactly what's in those accounts because the way that the anti-issue two folks are putting it through there is it was put into a foundation, and the foundation is parceling out the money.
Right.
So we can't go to the foundation and say, oh, we want to see who your donors are and how much they gave and all this other stuff. We can't do that because it's a foundation versus an actual PAC, a political action committee, where they have to file all that information with the Secretary of State's office.
But it's a whole lot more money than was spent even in the casino gambling issue, ballot issue, which was enormous, something like $48, $49 million. I mean, this is going to dwarf that.
Right.
And Joe, this is being called the Drug Price Relief Act. What exactly is this particular issue designed to do?
Well, the Drug Price Relief Act would basically, what it says is it would set the price of drugs for Medicaid and for state programs. It would set it at the same amount that the VA pays. Now, here's the problem. No one is certain exactly what the VA pays.
Nor do they have to reveal it, do
they? They don't have to tell anybody.
Yeah. That's right. They don't have to say anything. And you're seeing a lot of questions that have been raised over this by news organizations has been the fact that no one can prove how much money it's going to save and that, you know, it might, if it's passed, it might be unwieldy and the lawmakers would have to come back and change it. And then there's this little provision in issue two that basically says that the individuals who are bringing issue two forward, that should lawmakers or courts or something decide in the future, if it passes, if they decide in the future to try to change it, the individuals behind issue two, the state has to pay their legal costs. And that could be a lot of money. Right. Of course, the state defends all kinds of things. So the state is used to, you know, paying legal costs for any number. Every law that wants to be challenged in court, you know, people want to challenge it in court, the state's defending it. So it's not like that's unheard of. But basically, the individuals behind issue two do not want to get buried with paperwork and with expensive lawsuits. So that was what they say is the purpose of putting that in there. They also say they plan not to use it unless they have to. But, of course, that's not in writing. So, you know, what is in writing is that the state has to pay those legal fees.
Who is backing issue two, Joe?
Issue two is being backed by a gentleman out of California, and actually it's a foundation that he runs. It's an AIDS foundation. They help AIDS patients. They help them pay for medicine when they can't afford it. They provide services and support. It's a
nonprofit.
Yeah. It's a total nonprofit.
Now, they're saying that this will be a way to control drug prices. Would it benefit people on private insurance, or how exactly would this work?
Well, the backers behind this say that it's going to save about $400 million. Although, you know, people who've looked at it, they can't verify that for the most part. Editorial boards can't verify it because we go back to that thing where you can't get the drug prices, right?
Right.
But they're saying $400 million would be saved. The other side says that the pharma side of the issue, the vote no side, they say, well, you know, this could just end up raising prices for everyone else. And some political experts I talked to last week seem to think that the anti-issue two side is kind of using that as a threat to get people to vote no on it, and that they're spending so much money here in Ohio because they want to send a very, very strong message that they don't want this in another state. They don't want this battle to be waged somewhere else. And if they bury it now, they might be able to stop it so that it doesn't go nationwide. At least that's what some of the political analysts are thinking.
Yeah, and that's a principal message that's coming out of their advertising, is that this is going to end up costing you, the person who does not have some kind of a state health insurance like Medicare or Medicaid, you know, other programs. If you're getting like private insurance, that your drug prices are going to go up. And really, there's not any evidence for that, you know, because as Joe pointed out, we don't know what the VA pays, and the VA doesn't have to tell anybody how much they pay.
Howard, is there a confusion factor at play in this particular issue that Mark, might cause it some trouble?
In state ballot issues, there's always a confusion factor, okay? I mean, almost without exception. And in my experience with these things, that if people don't understand or completely understand a ballot issue that they see on their ballot, no matter how much advertising they've seen on television, because you become kind of numb to that after a while, after you've seen the same ads, you know, 500 times. If they don't understand it and they're not sure about it, they will vote no. And that's usually the case.
Joe, would you agree with that?
Yes, that's definitely the case from what we see here when we look at ballot issues. I mean, going into something, you really have an advantage being on the vote no side of it anyway.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, when people get confused, they do tend to vote no. The other thing is,
or not vote at all.
That's it. That's exactly what I was going to say, Howard. Yeah. Sometimes they just don't vote at all because they're confused about it.
Now, Marcy's law would amend Ohio's constitution. Now, on issue two, Joe, is that going to be an amendment to the Constitution, or what are we talking about here?
No, essentially it would make issue two a state law. But that's the reason, you know, when I was talking about the attorneys and the legal costs and all that, that's why that's in there, because they realize it could be a state law. Therefore, it can be challenged in court. Therefore, lawmakers can change it. There's all kinds of things that can happen when it's a state law. And that's the reason they wrote the protections in there, so that they say they can protect and make sure that this law stands and that, you know, Big Pharma can't go out and buy off a bunch of lawmakers who then change it or try to do away with it or something like that.
So if somebody wants to study up on these two issues, well, where can they order some resources for that?
Well, I would say the best way to study up on these is to go to your local PBS and your local NPR station and look at everything on the website, because we've been doing a lot of reporting on this.
That's right.
So that's the first place I'd go. But then also, the League of Women Voters, they have great resources out there that are nonpartisan.
And even the Secretary of State. Yeah.
I was going to say that. Secretary of State's website.
Sure.
You know, and after this election, we're not done, because we're going to head into the statewide races for Ohio. Mm-hmm. So where do things stand in the governor's race at this point? What's the latest on that?
Well, okay.
It's getting kind of interesting, isn't it?
It is getting interesting. Yes, it is. Over the weekend, last weekend, we had a Supreme Court justice who announced his intentions to run. Justice Bill O'Neill, one of only two Democrats, elected Democrats in statewide government, the other one being Sherrod Brown. And he's the only Democrat on the court. And he decided, he told reporters that he wants to enter the gubernatorial race. And then after that, he talked about some issues that he would like to change, legalizing marijuana and some other things. Well, then, like a couple days later, Ohio's auditor, Dave Yost, he comes out, he says, wait, you can't do that. Supreme Court, the Chief Justice kind of made a comment that, you know, if you're going to do that, you can't be on the court, you can't give positions on things. And so now there's a real question as to whether he's overstepped what is allowed as a justice, and whether he's maybe out there too far, and there's questions as to whether he'll stay on the court.
Dave Yost kind of started a banal, the Ohio Republican Party establishment is just ganged up on him.
They're having a field day with this?
Oh, yeah. You know, I'm saying, hey, look, you're either on the Supreme Court or you're a candidate for governor. Choose one.
Right.
And that's going to be very difficult for Bill O'Neill, because Bill O'Neill's already said, and he was saying, you know, if Rich Cordray got into the race, that he wouldn't do this. You know, he'd get
out. Politically, it's difficult, too, because the Democrats have been very vocal about their opposition to some other members of the court who have spoken at events that are, you know, that I think it was a Right to Life event that Justice Kennedy spoke at earlier this year. And, you know, they're like, wait a minute, she shouldn't be speaking there. You know, she'll have to, you know, rule on abortion issues. And since she spoke there, she should recuse herself. So, you know, they've said that already. So you've got this issue now where their candidate, one of their candidates is in that situation. It's really a tough situation now for everyone to work their way through, and I don't know what's going to happen, quite honestly.
And when you have four other announced Democratic candidates
what's the effect on them?
Running, you know, they're running, and they're running their campaigns, raising money, going around the state and collecting endorsements, debating each other now.
Right.
Bill O'Neill's going to have to make a decision. He's really going to have to decide, okay, am I serious about this, or do I want to stay on the court?
You know. And he said that what he really wants is for Rich Cordray to jump into the race.
He wants Cordray in, sure.
And Rich Cordray, of course, is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau chief in Washington, D.C. He has strong ties to Ohio. He's served in Ohio before. And, you know, he has more name recognition than certainly the other four that are on the,
He's actually been elected to statewide constitutional offices like Ohio Attorney General and state treasurer.
So at this point, we have four Democrats in the governor's race, possibly five.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And then on the Republican side, we've got, what, four candidates
four
as well?
Four candidates,
there.
Yeah.
Possibility of any more popping up along the way?
Yeah, I mean, they're sort of like, yeah, if there's a big rain, I mean, you know, mushrooms pop up,
I think that,
but,
you know.
It's not, I don't think it's going to grow a great deal. Yeah. I mean, it's getting kind of late in the game to get.
But Rich Cordray could still come in.
Cordray,
I mean,
is
here's,
an exception, yeah.
Yeah. And here's the thing about Cordray. If he comes in, it will take him about 5 minutes to raise money because right. He already has people in high places with deep pockets who can give money to fund his campaign.
Yes.
And so he is in a different position than all of those who have declared and are running right now.
He could get in the race and raise $20 million just in a flash.
But but beyond Rich Cordray, I take it that's it. There's no other names floating around at this time.
Well, there's always Jerry
Springer.
Jerry hasn't
been heard from lately, and frankly, I'm not convinced that Jerry's ever going to do that.
Starting to have my
doubts. Yeah, I'm with Howard. I'm with Howard on that.
Joe, question for you about the Ohio House. They passed another abortion ban. Tell us about this.
Okay, well, this abortion ban would basically at the point that a fetus could be diagnosed with Down syndrome, at that point that diagnosis is made, it would say that doctors could not perform abortions and that the abortion could not be based on that Down syndrome diagnosis. That's passed the House. It's now going to the Senate. It passed pretty much along the party lines. There is opposition against it, mostly Democrat. And, of course, you know, I think there were 30 votes against it and double that number for it. So it's got enough, definitely has enough momentum to go over to the House and be seriously considered and possibly pass there.
So pass the House and now goes to the Senate, is that right order?
Right, goes to the Senate. Mm-hmm.
Does it have to go through any committee hearings first or just straight to the Senate?
Oh, yeah, it'll go through some Senate committee hearings or we think it will. You know, sometimes things get pushed through without committee hearings, but I think it'll probably go through some committee hearings and we'll probably hear the same arguments that were raised this time around. The people who like it, who don't like it, I should say, they say that this is infringing upon a woman's right to choose, which is constitutionally affected or constitutionally mandated, and that people who are affected by this, that it's a hard decision for them, and there's a lot that goes into it, and that, you know, basically lawmakers shouldn't be making that decision for families who really are in a tough position anyway. Those are the basic arguments that are against it.
Joe, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Ohio Public Radio's Joe Ingles and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. And an update on the Ohio governor's race. This morning, the Ohio Supreme Court announced that Justice Bill O'Neill will recuse himself from any future cases that come before the court. He previously said he would step down from the bench by the February 7th candidate filing deadline for governor. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Dave Shermer was the technical director. William White composed the Cincinnati Edition theme music. I'm Mark Haney. Disabled American Veterans, or DAV, was first imagined at a 1919 Cincinnati Christmas party. It was officially created the following year as the Disabled American Veterans of the World War.
Today, the DAV has more than 1 million members. On the next Cincinnati edition, we'll look at the history and mission of the DAV. We'll also get a preview of the Cincinnati Zoo's upcoming Native Plant Symposium. That's Cincinnati edition, Monday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.